are late stage for the most part, led by Lymphir, which is our cancer compound. It's an IL-2 diphtheria toxin fusion protein for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which is a very rare disease. It's an orphan drug as categorized by the FDA. Mino-Lok, which is our antibiotic lock solution, potentially, once it's approved, will be the first and only antibiotic lock solution of its kind in the market. It's indicated for salvaging or sterilizing infected central venous catheters. Halo-Lido, which is kind of a field from the first two drugs that I just described for you, simply because it's a hemorrhoid drug, and I know that kind of doesn't fit with what I've said here. But the reason we have this drug is because we started out as a private company in 2014, and then in 2016 we merged with we needed to have a public company listing, so we merged in with Citius, and Citius had this drug in their portfolio. So we took a good look at it and recognized that there was some significant potential here. And the reason is that, believe it or not, in the 21st century, there isn't a single FDA-approved prescription drug for the treatment of hemorrhoids, which is really hard to believe. You do have the over-the-counter side of the market, which has Preparation H and other products like that. The other two drugs are preclinical, and at this point, we are not devoting any resources to those drugs. We've minimized those programs. The markets that we serve are substantial. The CTCL market is, as I said, it's a rare disease. There are only about 2,000 to 3,000 patients annually with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. So it's got a potential of about $300 to $400 million, roughly. And there's some interesting market dynamics that I'll be able to point out to you once I get to that part of the presentation. Mino-Lok is indicated in the catheter-related bloodstream infections or central line-associated bloodstream infection marketplace, and that market is non-existent at the moment because there's nothing there for it. But once Mino-Lok is approved, we're estimating it's about a $1.8 billion market, half of it in the United States, half of it outside the U.S. The prescription hemorrhoid market probably is the one that has the greatest potential out of anything that I've just described here, simply because there are millions of patient visits to doctor's offices for hemorrhoids, and there's nothing there for the doctor to be able to prescribe. So in terms of the financial side, the company has $33 million cash on its balance sheet as of 6/30. That cash should be sufficient to last us through August of 24. We did a registered direct offering back in May for $15 million, and we do have a complete response letter from the FDA that I cover that's not going to have any substantial financial impact for the company. Most importantly, something that all of you can go to the next 100 meetings of this type and you won't hear this, and that is that management has put their own money into the company. I have $22.5 million invested directly, not in stock options, not in warrants, not in anything. So, the co-founder of the company, Myron Alubiak, has $4 million invested directly. So, and the reason we do is because we have great confidence in terms of our portfolio and of our ability to get these drugs approved and through the FDA. Plus, in reality, we're all in entrepreneurs. So you've got to have skin in the game if you expect to raise money from others. So we do have some value-driving catalysts that we'll cover shortly. So I call this our mugshots. So this is our company, basically. So so we used to have only six people in the company, but once we got Lymphir, that drug, we had to add to our staff. We realized that. So we're up to about 22. It's not going to get that much bigger, except for a sales and marketing group, probably down the road. My background, very quickly, it's a combination of the corporate side, and then I went entrepreneurial, formed several companies, had great exits as a result of that, that's enabled me to do what I love to do. So Myron Halubiak, who's a co-founder of the company, his background is he grew up at Hoffman LaRoche, basically. Started out the sales side, worked his way up the ranks, became the vice president of marketing, and then ultimately he left Roche, started his own company, had a strategic consulting company for Big Pharma that he ran very successfully, sold it to Dun & Bradstreet, was running that unit for DMB when Roche called and asked him to come back to the company and to become president of Roche Labs US, which he served in a number of years. I'm not going to cover everybody. I just want to highlight, though, Dr. Myron Czuczman, our chief medical officer. We brought him on board just about somewhere around 2020. And Myron is really a true KOL. Now, he's not just a KOL. He's a global KOL in that he spent 23 years at Roswell Park in Buffalo as the chief of lymphoma. He published 180 papers. And after 23 years there, he went to Celgene for 5 years, for which we're really grateful for, because Celgene really took an academic and trained him in the ways of industry. So with that, once Celgene sold out to Bristol-Myers, Myron did not want to be part of a larger company, so he wanted to be part of a smaller company, which he enjoys that kind of atmosphere. And we couldn't ask for a better CMO in terms of not only just his knowledge, but he's brilliant, but also of his reputation is worldwide. He knows all the chief oncologists around the world. So what we did also is, you see Dr. Kelly Creighton, Catherine Kessler, and Nick Berlew, those three individuals, we pirated it out of our consulting company that we were paying to do all our consulting work in CMC, regulatory, and quality assurance. So we thought it'd be easier if we had them all on board with us once we did, once we acquired that license for Lymphere. So it's a great team. I should add this. We do not have any internships, training programs, or trainees, or management trainees, or anybody like that in a company. Our company is 100% professional. So some of the milestones and developments that we've had, basically, Lymphere, as you see, we acquired that asset, the license for it, in September of 21. The trial was over by two, three months after we acquired it. We filed a BLA in the third quarter of 22, and I'm going to cover what happened when I get into Lymphere with the complete response letter that we got. It's a, you know, a complete response letter is a great term because a lot of people confuse it and think it means an approval. Actually, when we got that letter and publicized it, I got emails from shareholders around the country congratulating us for getting a complete response letter, which was ironic. But nevertheless, we'll have a resubmission on that complete response letter in the very early part of 24. January 24 is our target. Mino-Lok, which was really our first asset and the asset that we started the company with, is just about complete now with its clinical trial. Our goal there was 92 events, and I'll highlight for you now that we're over 92. We are over enrolling, and deliberately so that we can make sure that we'll have the right number of patients in there for the submission to the FDA when it goes in. Halo-Lido, we just completed a phase 2B trial. We're shooting for meeting with the FDA to end a phase 2B meeting, also to work out a phase 3 protocol, and we'll cover that shortly. So let me get into Mino-Lok for you. So Mino-Lok it's an antibiotic lock solution that contains minocycline, sodium EDTA as a chelating agent, and alcohol. It was invented by Dr. Issam Rad, who's the chief of infectious disease at MD Anderson in Texas. And he worked on this project for a number of years, trying to come up with a solution that you could administer without compromising the time for IV treatment. So there are solutions that could be out there that would take hours to work or days even, and that would severely compromise IV flow for mostly cancer patients. So 4 million central venous catheters are inserted annually, and out of that total, somewhere around 500,000 of those catheters will get infected. So, and once a patient gets infected with that catheter gets infected, that patient has to be hospitalized immediately. 18 to 20% adverse event profile, or even higher in certain cases. You can die actually from an infected catheter. The cost for a catheter-related bloodstream infection is substantial. It's $65,000 and up. And the only standard of care today is to remove the catheter and replace it surgically in another spot. So what Dr. Rad came up with was an option here, and that is a Minolox solution. So basically, the way it works, and I'll show you, I'll demonstrate it quickly for you. This is the catheter. So the catheter, when it's surgically inserted, it goes to the superior vena cava of the heart. And the nurse will come in, inject the solution into the catheter and the line. The line actually gets locked. So it's locked using hemodynamic principles. So this, our solution does not go into man. It does not go into the body. It's designed strictly to sterilize and that catheter. So basically, the nurse will do this. The solution will sit in the catheter and align for 2 hours. At the end of 2 hours, the nurse comes in, aspirates out the contents, flushes the line, and the patient has 22 hours of uninterrupted IV flow. And you do this for 5 to 7 days in a row. At the end of 5 to 7 days in a row, that line is completely sterilized, including, by the way, any biofilm, which is basically bacterial slime that forms on the inner walls of the catheter. Bacteria have a real affinity for plastic, and that's why they propagate and grow very quickly once that infection gets inside that line. So this is a real major advance. And with that, basically, MD Anderson ran a phase 2B trial. They compared the Minolox solution to remove and replace. All types of bacteria were tested. And as you can see, there were no side effects, 100% effectiveness with the Minolox solution versus about an 18% adverse event profile with remove and replace. So with that, we went to the FDA, and I have to say this, with the FDA had absolutely no experience whatsoever in being able to evaluate a clinical trial in this setting, because nobody had ever come to them with anything. So at this point, it took a while, but we finally, after a series of meetings, we worked out a protocol with them, and that protocol had an active arm of the Minolox solution. The control arm was an antibiotic lock solution, what I call a home brew. So what happens is this. There are certain cases when a patient gets an infected catheter that remove and replace is no longer an option because they no longer have any access points left. So at that point, the hospital will try to do all they can to salvage the catheter so that it can be maintained. And they'll use vancomycin and other types of antibiotics to try and sterilize it with mixed results. So the FDA, this is what we have. The primary endpoint is time to catheter failure. It's a negative endpoint. So that's what we're measuring. We had three reads on this with a DMC, and all three reads indicated that we're hitting our endpoints, continue with the trial. So the clinical site started out in the United States. We got, like everybody else, we got COVIDized. So once COVID hit, it stopped just about the clinical trials here. We've managed to eke some out. And then finally, earlier in the year, we opened up trials in India in order to really finish this up. So the goal is 92 events. And as I've said before, we're over that number now because we're over enrolling, and so we'll be finished shortly. And something that in terms of status that we have, the FDA actually advised us to do this. They advised that we file for a QIDP status, which stands for Qualified Infectious Disease Product. This is awarded to only breakthrough antibiotics. So as most of you probably know, there is no more antibiotic research going on in this country. The last five independent companies that tried to do something here with antibiotics and got approved all went bankrupt. So so the FDA and major pharma companies got out of this business a long time ago. So they set up QIDP to encourage and foster antibiotic research. We got the QIDP designation. What it does for us is it the review time, once we file an NDA for this, is going to be cut in half from 12 months to 6 months. But I think the best attribute and the best part about a QIDP is that we get regulatory protection over and beyond what most companies get. So every company, when you get an NDA approved with the FDA, you'll get 3 to 5 years under Hatch-Waxman. So regardless of your patent status, you could have another 10 years left on it, but you'll get that as absolute guarantee that nobody can jump you during that time frame. With QIDP, they add another 5 years to it, so we'll have close to 9 to 10 years, which is a long runway that's guaranteed. No generic company can come in and do what's known as a Paragraph 4, which is an awful thing to happen to any branded company. We also have fast track designation and also patent protection extended for up to 5 years in the EU. So with that, let me move into Lymphir. So Lymphir is the drug that we acquired from Dr. Reddy. So what I need to highlight for you is the history of this drug, because you have to really understand it before I get into all of it, and that is this. So this drug was originally developed by Ligand, and Ligand developed it. They sold it to Eisai Pharmaceuticals, the big Japanese pharma company. Eisai got it approved. It went on a market, but the condition of the approval at that time was that Eisai agreed to reformulate the drug, not for safety reasons, but the FDA wanted unfolded proteins to be removed from that formulation. The issue that, and they were on a market for about 3 years, the issue that Eisai had was, this is a very hard drug to make with long lead times. They did not have sufficient inventory to do the reformulation work. So they finally decided that they would pull the drug from the market, do the reformulation work, which they did. When they completed it, they went to the FDA, and the FDA said, sorry, but you have a new drug, and you have to do a phase 3 over again, and also with 71 patients, and also a lead-in of 21 patients. So with that, that was 2014. So this is a very hard drug to study because of this very small number of patients that are available to you in a pool. So it's taken all this time to go through this process. So what happened here was Eisai got into the program. They were at it. They were doing their own clinical research. They ran the clinical trials themselves. They did not use a clinical research organization, a CRO. And somewhere like 2017, they decided to license the drug to Dr. Reddy's of Japan, of India. And Dr. Reddy's is a big generic company, and they were expanding on, all of a sudden they decided they were going to become a branded company in the United States. So they started acquiring branded assets. They picked this one up along with the dermatological drugs that had revenues. 2019, 2020, and meantime, by the way, Eisai continued doing all the work. So Dr. Reddy's had oversight. So 2019, 2020, Dr. Reddy's decides we're getting out of the branded business. So, and they jettisoned everything. There was an auction, and basically we won the auction. So that auction was for that asset, and we paid $40 million up front at that time. The reason we did is because they were on their very last patient. So as you can see here, so basically we got that third quarter again, filed for that BLA, got that the CRL, and that's where we stand right now. So what does a CRL mean? A term, which is a very ironic term, complete response letter, means that the FDA has identified something that hasn't been completed in your filing, which was true. So we had, there was a manufacturing test on the final product that passed, but the validation for the test was not yet complete. So we had a July 28th PDUFA date, but our validation test was going to take all the way out to the end of October, early part, somewhere in November. So we thought, based on the way everything was going with the agency, they would give us a conditional approval upon that validation test being completed. That was not the case, CRL. So with a CRL, it doesn't mean that you have to redo your entire file or anything like that. You only submit what they've identified in that letter to you. So we responded back to the agency with a plan of what we're doing. They accepted it. And so our response is going to go in January. At the time that your response goes in, the FDA then gives you new PDUFA dates. So they have two options on this. Either it's a PDUFA date 2 months from the time of your resubmission or 6 months from the time of your resubmission. So that pretty much is where it stands right now. We are planning to move ahead and launch this drug somewhere probably in July of 24. We've been working with Eversana, and we're ready to go. We've identified everything in the marketplace that has to be identified. So this is CTCL. So it starts out as a rash, and ultimately, when it progresses into the tumor phase, it is what you can see. It's more prevalent in men than women, usually in their 50s and 60s. A characteristic of CTCL is severe itching. And so the objective for the oncologist is to maintain and try to keep the patient's life longer. This disease has a lot of variability to it. Some people never come out of that first phase and stay at that first phase forever. Others move rapidly into the second phase. Others don't move rapidly. It's all over the place in terms of the way it progresses. So this is we've got a good market potential here for 300 to 400 million. What we like about it is it's got a very concentrated prescriber base. Now, we said we're working with Eversana. We have found we now identified all the prescribers in this category, and the number of them is 2,000. So with 2,000 prescribers, we have we plan to put in the field 20 reps. It'll be a combination of medical service liaison reps and regular Salesforce reps. So one other thing I just want to highlight here, though. I'll highlight it later. So the MOA, or mechanism of action, that we have for the drug is unique in that it targets malignant cells and eliminates immunosuppressive Tregs. Basically, this is the competition. Seagen has Adcetris, Kyoto Kirin, a Japanese company, at Portoligo. As I said, what happens here is any entry that comes in is additive to the market. You're not taking market share away from anybody because of the way that this disease is treated. The oncologist will go from one drug to the next. There's no 1, 2, 3. So I'll skip that for right now. This was our study, the lead-in trial, as you can see here, 21-71, basically 36.2 objective response rate. 49% of the patients experienced a complete response or partial response. We had good response time, 1.4 months, and then a durable response lasting about 6.5 months. So these were the side effects. Which now, basically, there is upside here for us that is significant if it works. So we have two investigator INDs. Those are studies that get initiated by outside investigators in either a hospital setting or an academic setting. They can research unapproved indications. So the one at the University of Pittsburgh, that investigator is looking at the combination of Lymphir with Keytruda. He's using it to treat Keytruda failures. So it's going to be real interesting to see how that works out. And at University of Minnesota, it's Lymphir combined with CAR-T. So both of these are hot areas. We realize that there's a lot of work being done in this area with a lot of other companies. I would love to see it work, but we'll see probably by next year when they get to somewhere, enroll somewhere around 10 to 15 patients. If they get positive results, there'll be a journal article somewhere in a breaking journal about their results. So Halo-Lido is our hemorrhoid drug. So basically, we did a 300-patient study, April 23, that we're now getting ready to submit all that data to the FDA, have an end-of-phase 2B meeting with them, see if we can come up with a protocol that's relatively inexpensive for us. And if we can, then we're going to take that data once we generate it, and we'll attempt to monetize this asset for shareholders by selling it to big pharma or mid-sized pharma. It's not for us. 1,000-person sales force, direct-to-consumer advertising, is strictly not for us at this point. So in terms of our profile, as you can see here, 158 million shares outstanding, warrants of about 50 million at this point. So I should point out that myself and Myron Lubiak, probably we have about 12 million of these warrants. Most of these warrants are all plain vanilla warrants, and hopefully somewhere down the road, they will enable us to be cashed in and provide some additional cash for the company. I'm the single largest shareholder in the company at the moment, and I should highlight one last thing for you in terms of Lymphir and what we're planning to do there. We are placing that drug into a subsidiary, and then that subsidiary will go public in a pubco, and the reason for that is we are not diluting the city of shareholders anymore. So the purpose of that is to be able to raise capital for the launch and the launch expenses associated with the launch of Lymphir. Our plan is that once that pubco is trading and has maturity in its trading, we'll stage in a distribution of the pubco shares to the city of shareholders. So they'll get participation in both. So with that, any questions at this point? All of you will be given a written exam before you can leave here. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.